everyone. Welcome to Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. In the time since the Ukraine-Russia conflict erupted in late February, much has changed, particularly in the financial realm, with major moves having been made in the international financial system to ostensibly punish Russia for the country's military operation in Ukraine. Yet despite its officially stated purpose, the ruble, Russia's currency, regained its value about a month after these measures were imposed, and many of the sanctions' negative effects seem to have had a greater impact on the West than their ostensible target. This reality has left some scratching their heads in confusion, while others suspect incompetence or an ulterior motive is to blame. After all, it makes little practical sense to, quote-unquote, punish your enemy via measures that have a worse economic impact on your people than theirs. Aside from sanctions, other actions taken by Western governments are having other historical ramifications, including the potential end of the dollar's dominance as the world reserve currency, as well as the collapse of the petrodollar system. As the dollar's dominance comes into question now more than ever, so too has the U.S.'s hegemony that it has enjoyed in the post-World War II period, opening the door to the so-called multipolar world order. Yet with so much in flux, other finance-focused policies continue to march ahead in both blocks of this war. This includes central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs, which in some cases at least have seemed to advance as the Ukraine-Russia conflict opens up a new chapter in global crisis and instability. Despite there being two sides in this conflict, it seems that the adoption of CBDCs and the control system behind that system are continuing to advance in both Ukraine and Russia, as well as among their respective allies. Today, I'm lucky enough to be joined by John Titus to discuss the major and historic financial shifts of recent weeks, as well as the state of the global central bank digital currency agenda. John is the founder of the Best Evidence YouTube channel, also found on Odyssey and BitChute, which examines the major financial and legal forces shaping today's dystopia, specifically in the United States. And he is also a frequent contributor to Catherine Austin Fitz's Solari Report. If you are a regular listener to this podcast, you may remember John from episode 25, where we discuss central bank digital currencies in detail. For those not familiar with CBDCs and their implications, I highly recommend revisiting that episode before enjoying this one. With that being said, welcome back to Unlimited Hangout, John. How have you been since we last spoke?
I've been really good, Whitney. It's good to be back.
Hey, well, that's super that you've been doing doing good in these increasingly crazy times. Definitely a lot to take in these days when you work in, you know, sort of absorbing all the news that's being thrown at us constantly. And a lot of stuff has been happening since we last talked, as I noted in my introduction. So, you know, there is a lot that we can cover. Is there anywhere in particular you'd like to start when it comes to the changes that have been foisted upon the world since late February?
Yeah, let me start with one that that nobody's talking about.
Oh, good. Even better.
It's a significant one. And I don't know that nobody's talking about it. I try not to look at other people's content just because I don't want influences on my head other than my own. So I'm pretty sure that nobody's talking about this. But on March 2nd of this year, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, got up in front of the House Financial Services Committee. And he was asked a question about an hour into that hearing. And the question was, hey, you know, we noticed China and Russia are transacting exclusively in their own native currencies. And Pakistan is thinking about, you know, entering into the fray. And basically, everybody's getting out of the dollar. What effect might this have on the U.S. economy? And Powell's answer was, he immediately almost went to, well, you know, we have the world reserve currency now, but, you know, that could change. And there's been two world reserve currencies before. And then he says, you know, the things that really keep us the world reserve currency are, one, we have, you know, historically have had low inflation. And two, we've had the rule of law. So I started laughing. It's like, well, we don't have low inflation's out the window.
Yeah.
That leaves the rule of law. And that's out the window, too. I've documented that extensively on my YouTube channel for a long time in BitChute and Odyssey. You know, I've been off for a long time. That's gone on to a certainty. We haven't had the rule of law since late 2012. But those are out the window. But I thought it was interesting that Powell immediately, despite the fact that the question was limited to what's the effect on the U.S. economy? He goes to world reserve currency right away. That's a major tell. And his answer, I made a video about this called Your Federal Reserve Cancer Prescription is Ready for Pickup. And I sort of walked through his testimony, but his testimony is clearly, to me, as someone who watches witnesses, memorized. It's very scripted. And I thought that was just a very interesting thing that he talks about that, because it comes on the heels of his talking about the world reserve currency like that, like it may be in jeopardy. It comes on the heels of official acknowledgement, both by Powell and by Yellen, and really by BlackRock, that the U.S. fiscal path is no longer sustainable. And that kind of talk you didn't hear for a very long time, at least not from people in official positions. You always had people saying, oh, the debt clock is going crazy. It's ticking away. The debt's too high, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I've been hearing that since the 80s, okay? But what I never heard until very recently was public officials of that stature, of that rank, of cabinet-level officials say, you might have sub-cabinet officials saying there might have been a problem, but never a cabinet-level official saying, yeah, the debt path is unsustainable. We're going to need some severe austerity to bring this in line. And there's a Treasury report on that very fact. But that's a big development, because what it says is the days of the U.S. currency are numbered, because the debt path, it's out of control.
A lot has been going on with the discussion of the dollar's dominance essentially going away in terms of it being the world reserve currency. But before we explore some of those developments, could you perhaps explain what the end of that dominance would mean domestically for regular Americans?
Yeah, that would mean that a lot of, right now, I'll give you an example. The currency in circulation, that means cash. That's sitting probably $2.3 trillion. Most of that is 70% of that, the estimates, nobody really knows because it's paper, can't be tracked as easily. But estimates are that 70% of that $2.3 trillion is overseas. It's not, because a lot of countries, people, you know, regular workers in countries that are smaller, their currency, their native currency isn't as reliable and it's consistent or predictable as the dollar. You know, the dollar is like an enormous iceberg. It takes a long time to shift it, whereas smaller currencies are way more volatile. So a lot of people convert their paychecks in foreign countries into U.S. dollars. They just keep them in cash. And that's where a lot of the money is, not to mention illicit drug transactions going on, also funded probably in paper. If the U.S. loses, to the extent the U.S. loses world reserve currency status, those dollars are going to flow back into the U.S. And remember, those dollars are part of the U.S. monetary base. U.S. monetary base consists of paper, which is currency in circulation, it's cash, plus reserves, which are digital. So you're looking at a big portion of the monetary base come sloshing back home. And that's going to have a sharp tendency to increase inflation, which is already going on right now.
Yeah. So it's going to make that even worse then.
It's going to exacerbate that big mm-hmm. time. So it's a potential problem. It's a real problem. Not to mention the fact that we have gotten away with, for a long time, the U.S. is basically exporting. Its main exports are, you know, violence, you know, wars, illegal yeah. wars, and fraud. And it doesn't really produce that much of the U.S. So it looks like we're at an inflection point where that joyride is coming to an end.
Right. Well, the petrodollar system, which through all of this is being called into question as well, is partly supported by U.S. military supremacy and action throughout the world. And since some of the developments we've seen in this relatively brief period of time involve the Saudis, with whom the petrodollar system was originally negotiated right. in the 70s with the next administration, essentially siding with Russia, or I don't know if I want to say 100% siding with Russia, but they didn't, you know, toe the line they were asked right. to by Washington. And the same is true for the United Arab Emirates as well, who at least U.S. media is alleging is helping Russian nationals circumvent Western sanctions. Can you talk a little bit about the petrodollar system and how all of this is essentially in flux since, Washington and their allies tried to bring out the big guns,
sure.
Economically speaking?
Basically, since August 15th, 1971, up until that point in the Bretton Woods system, the U.S. dollar is gold-backed, meaning it was a narrow backing, meaning that I think it was only sovereign nations who had dollars could redeem those dollars at the Federal Reserve window for gold at the rate of $35 an ounce. And what happened is, I think it was de Gaulle said, "Oh yeah, $35 an ounce. Well, I've got $35 million out here on a boat. I'd like 1 million ounces of gold." And Richard Nixon's like, "Oh hell no!" And he shut the gold window. So at that point, the U.S. dollar was untethered. What that really meant was that the Federal Reserve was free to create as many dollars as it wanted out of thin air without any real liability. When it was gold backed, you had to worry about guys like de Gaulle coming up saying, "Hey, I want my gold." But once that peg breaks, everybody knows the Fed is kind of free to issue as much currency as it wants. And that could create problems. And for sure, the gold price immediately began to float in the upward direction. And so what the solution, sort of the partial solution of that, was implemented and supposedly devised by Henry Kissinger in 1973, and that was the petrodollar, to keep up the demand for the gold. Since you just eliminated a kind of a strong psychological component behind the dollar, which is dollar strong, it's backed by gold. You just eliminated that. You need something to counterbalance that. And the measure to sort of counteract the breaking of the gold peg was the petrodollar, which basically said, if you're an oil producing nation, Saudi Arabia, whoever, thou shalt conduct all oil transactions in dollars. So that because the whole world needs oil to operate, if you go to the oil producing nations and say, you have to conduct your oil transactions in dollars, you've just put in a floor under the dollar that's very real. You have to remember that the powers that be are very good at putting in place. They don't have to control the whole world. They just need to control the critical junctions. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. Rockefeller realized, I don't need to control the whole oil industry. I just need to control the drill bits. That's it. No drill bits, no oil. So he got patents on all the drill bits. And that's how there's a big measure of control over the oil industry. The petrodollar is sort of the same notion. You don't need to control the whole wide world. Just control the purchase of oil. And then you got them. And that was really the origin of the petrodollar. So now, flash forward to today, if you have so those countries, Saudi Arabia and Emirates, they get on board and they agree with that. Okay, so they are at that time, back in 1973 and up till recently, they're really sort of easily controllable by the U.S. And now you're seeing, you're getting a lot of lip from these guys. So now NATO goes to them and says, "Hey, how about getting on board with the Russian sanctions?" And they're like, no, we're not doing that. So you're getting pushback from people who right. used to be unquestionable sort of levers of your own power. And now they're not levers.
Yeah, that's really, I think, a big development when you consider the fact that, well, at least the theories anyway, that one of the motivations behind like the Iraq War, for example, was that Saddam Hussein had started selling oil in euros, and that one of the motivations behind intervention in Libya during the Obama administration was efforts by Gaddafi to sell oil in a gold-backed dinar. And that sort of, the protection of the petrodollar system has informed major U.S. military action in the past, or at least coups, things of that nature.
Yeah.
What do you expect some of that to appear? Some have suggested that the alleged almost coup against Imran Khan in Pakistan was motivated by this. I don't know if you have any thoughts.
You know, I don't really know what's going on in Pakistan. I do know that that is a rather curious development. You have this popular figure getting ousted all of a sudden, you know, by what appears to be two long entrenched dynasties there. But back to what you were saying about the petrodollar, it's not just messing with the petrodollar that'll get you in trouble with the U.S. It's also messing with the debt-backed monetary system, the debt-based monetary system in which you have private banks really issuing your money. You start to mess with that and start issuing money directly, you know, non-interest-bearing notes from the government. That's another way to land you in hot water. Either way, mess with the dollar and you're going to get in trouble. So I don't know the ins and outs of what happened in Pakistan. It's been recent. I haven't had time to really look at it, but it is curious. And I have seen articles saying it was at the instigation of the U.S. No question about that. And remember that question to Powell, you know, I talked about on March 2nd in the House Financial Services Committee. The question was, hey, you know, Pakistan's getting in on the act. So there was already official recognition in early March that Pakistan was, I don't want to say in cahoots with, but there was already an indication as of early March that Pakistan was at a minimum monetarily friendly with Russia and China. So I can't imagine those two things are unconnected.
Another recent development is that Russia has pegged the ruble to gold, sort of, you know, the U.S. left the gold standard decades ago. And there's been some excitement, or a lot of excitement in some parts of the alternative media community over this development about, you know, a gold-backed ruble. What are your thoughts on that development?
I think a lot of that was, you know, the sanctions undeniably, I think, as you pointed out in your intro, had an impact on the ruble. You know, the ruble was in a long-term trend, but up until the kerfuffle in Ukraine, it was a long-term trend about 75 rubles per dollar. And when the sanctions really hit and the war got going, it spiked up to, I don't know, 125, 135. And now it's back down to, it looks like it's trending out at about 85. So there's been an impact. And undoubtedly, you know, Russia has taken measures to protect the ruble from that spike and bring it back to its long-term trend. And one of those measures was gold backing, but it wasn't the only measure. You know, the other measure was, hey, you know, you're going to sanction us, fine. You're not getting free gas. So from now on, you're going to pay. You don't have to pay us in rubles. You just have to, it's not the currency you need to pay us in. It's where you need to pay it. And you're going to pay it at a bank that's not under your sanctions. You're going to pay it at a bank that's in Russia, a Gazprom bank. We don't care what you pay it in. We'll sell the thing. If you want to pay us in euros, that's fine. We'll sell it on the market, sell your euros for rubles, and we'll do it that way. But Russia's taken any number of measures. I wouldn't read too much into the gold backing, because remember, the dollar was gold backed, right? Mm-hmm. It was gold backed from 44, whatever it was, 46 until 71. How'd that work out? That worked out with the gold window closing. So the gold backing is only as good as how much gold you have. And nobody really knows how much that is with either the U.S. or Russia. So it can always be broken. So the other thing about gold backing is there's really two forms to gold backing. Okay. Gold backing can mean really one of two things, depending on who's really issuing your money. If you, in a debt-based monetary system, gold as your reserve currency really means that when you have transactions between different parties that are issuing liability money, for example, banks, that they can settle up in gold. It's just how they settle their IOUs, right? So if you take on $100 of your neighbor's IOUs and your neighbor takes on $200 of your IOUs, you owe your neighbor $100. And the way that would settle historically was within gold. That's in a debt-based monetary system. In a monetary system where the real sovereign, where the nation is issuing its own money, like the U.S. issues quarters and dimes, right? There's been times in the U.S. where we issue our own money. The reason for our gold backing there is to prevent the government from issuing too much money. And I'll confess, I don't really know who is really in control of Russia. Okay. In the U.S., I can tell you, I know, because I've tracked it really well. Like I mentioned, the U.S. lost the rule of law some time ago, meaning that the real sovereign power in the U.S. is not the U.S. government. It's not the Congress. It's not the executive branch. It's not the judiciary. It's not any combination of those three. The real sovereign power of the U.S. is the financial powers that be. It's private banks mm-hmm. that are really in control of the U.S. And the way you know that is that in the wake of the financial crisis, those banks were not investigated. It's not that they weren't prosecuted. They weren't investigated. And when you look at that, it's like they weren't investigated. Like they didn't have to answer. They weren't even subpoenaed. I mean, my God, the president of the United States could be subpoenaed. We know that from U.S. versus Nixon in 1973 or 1974. I think it was 73. You know, the president of the United States can be subpoenaed in a criminal trial. He may not have to stand trial, but he can damn sure be subpoenaed. And the banks in the wake of the financial crisis, they weren't subpoenaed in large measure because the head of the DOJ at that time was a law firm called Covington & Burling that represented all those banks, represented all those Wall Street banks. And their top two guys, Eric Holder and Lanny Breuer, are running the DOJ. They're not subpoenaed. So where, pray tell, do the banks inherit or derive the sovereign power of not being subpoenaed? That tells you right there, if you're free to commit crimes and you're free from investigation, you're the sovereign power, period.
Well, not only that, you also have the Secretary of the Treasury at the time, Henry Paulson, demanding that, you know, Congress bail out the banks that weren't subpoenaed that you just referred to, or there would be martial law declared.
Yeah.
Is what congressmen were told. So give us free money or we'll declare martial law on you and take away your rights. That was basically the message there.
You know, my read on that bailout has changed over time. And I'm actually working on a documentary now, a multi-part documentary. It's going to be called Murder of a Rebel Nation. And that's a very critical episode. But if you think for a second, in the wake of the financial crisis, the real bailout wasn't TARP. It wasn't $700 billion from the Treasury. The real bailout came from the Fed. So it's like, well, mm-hmm. if you could bail out, if the Fed could have all along bailed out the banks with trillions of dollars, why didn't it do so? You know? And so you said, well, what was the real point of the Treasury bailout? And my read on it is really that they needed the powers that be needed the political cover. They needed to get politicians on the hook and behind the bailout, because when it was first proposed, people were so opposed to the bailout, like at 100-1, that if the Fed had just swooped in and bailed the banks out and bypassed Congress and bypassed the Treasury, there would have been an audit. As it was, there was an audit anyway. People were so pissed that in 2010, there was an audit as a result of efforts by Ron Paul on the right and Bernie Sanders on the left and a journalist from Bloomberg named Mark Pittman, who FOIA'd, you know, the Fed. There was an audit of the Fed. It was limited, but there was an audit. Had the Fed, though, in 2008 just bypassed all that and bailed out the banks, it for sure would have been an audit. It probably would have been full. So I think we're, you know, even though it's 14 years down the road since the bailout, we're still learning stuff about the bailout through FOIA and whatever else.
Yeah, that's I've actually come across stuff I didn't realize or really connect the dots before in writing my book on the Jeffrey Epstein scandal as it relates to Epstein's role in the collapse of Bear Stearns, and also as was reported on Wall Street on Parade, which is a pretty excellent financial focused blog. I think around the time of Epstein's arrest in 2019, they talked about how some of Epstein's entities that he controlled, like Liquid Funding, appeared to have received some of this Fed bailout money, secret Fed bailout money, and all of this stuff. So there definitely is a lot to still unearth about this, about that particular event in American financial history, for sure.
Yeah, Bear Stearns, that was not a failure. That Bear Stearns was executed. They were assassinated. They were pushed under a bus.
Yeah. Well, you know, it appears to have been based on court documents. So I guess this is a little bit of a spoiler for my book, but he appears to have been the pin that popped the that bubble at Bear Stearns, essentially.
Oh, wow. No kidding.
Yeah. The details on that forthcoming, but wow, anyway.
That's a headline right there. Way to go.
Well, there was actually another person who I'm blanking on their name right now, but we can probably throw their article in the show notes that sort of led me to that. So I can't take full credit, but it definitely is very interesting considering what we know now about his intelligence ties and things like that, you know, because it was initially framed as, oh, he did it because he was worried about his money, but he got all that money back from the Fed.
Yeah,
the
Bear Stearns bailout was March of 2008. And if you look at that window, say from March 2008 through, just arbitrarily end of 2009, the amount of skullduggery at that time is not to be believed. And it's still coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bear Stearns was a really dirty bank. I mean, you can take the the Epstein Association there. And there's a lot of really other crazy stuff that I've come across in that context, too. Like the role of one of Leslie Wexner's top cronies in selecting Jamie Dimon as head of J.P. Morgan. Yep. J.P. Morgan becomes Epstein's bank after Bear Stearns' collapse.
Which was the biggest beneficiary of that bailout. J.P. Morgan mopped up to the tune of about $55 billion from the failure of Bear Stearns.
Yeah, so it definitely seems to have been one of several financial coup d'etats of the past several decades, benefiting essentially the same network of people.
You got it.
It's a really crazy story. I don't know. Now it seems like we're in their end game.
Yes.
Financially. So, you know, there's a lot of history that I guess we could, you know, discuss it at length. But returning to the topics at hand, unless there's anything else you want to say on those matters,
just on the end game, because I think you're exactly right about the end game, but I'm going to explain what I agree we're in the end game, but I want to explain what I mean by the end game. I've got that my most recent video, Your Federal Reserve Cancer Prescription is Ready for Pickup, talks about this. The end game to me means the U.S. is now borrow. The end game to me means the U.S. is now borrowing to make its interest payment. Okay. And by interest, I don't mean just the interest on the debt, although that's included. The interest payment really is, it's what you owe as a result of a contract, be it a contract on a bond or a social contract like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and whatnot. You can't really cut those payments because the deal when you go into the labor force is, hey, you know, when you're younger and healthier, you pay into the system. And when you're older and weaker and you're out of, and you're not making as much money, you get your money back out of the system.
Mm-hmm.
When you add up interest plus Medicare plus Medicaid plus Social Security, it is now in excess of tax receipts. And you are thus borrowing to make your interest payments, meaning you're done. You now are looking at an exponential growth of debt way beyond your means, and it's over. And that's where the U.S. is right now. And that is why Powell and BlackRock and Yellen are all joining together saying, yeah, the fiscal path is unsustainable. They cite other reasons than what I just gave you, but that's the reason, rest assured.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say that the vast majority of Americans would not take kindly to the Social Security system, having been known to be insolvent for some time and not being informed about it until it's just like not there anymore.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the role of BlackRock and stuff, which we talked about the last time you were on, you know, they also, if I'm not mistaken, control a lot of America's pension funds as well, which is.
Well, they have $10 trillion in assets. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, recipe for total disaster, that's for sure. So anyway, going back to some of the stuff that's happened on the global level, we have this whole other development that we haven't quite discussed yet. Well, I think you alluded to it earlier about Russia asking unfriendly nations to pay for energy expenses, hydrocarbon purchases in the ruble. What's your take on that?
Yeah.
Do you think it'll work?
Well, Russia's got the gas. So yes, it's going to work.
Right.
Want the gas? I mean, what's your other option? If you don't want to pay for the gas, what are you going to beat it out of Russia? How's that working out for you in Ukraine? Not so well, is it?
Because you're right.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I've sort of considered here is that it might be a way for Europe to advance the Great Reset agenda, the sort of, you know, the WEF, the agenda as described by the WEF towards sort of green energy, quote unquote, which involves really squeezing out, even before all of this unfolded in Ukraine, sort of, squeezing the standard of living of the people there as it relates to energy availability. I don't know if you have any opinions on that.
Well, back to the Gazprom Bank. What Russia did was they said, hey, look, you know, it's not that you have to pay it in rubles. It's that you have to pay it to a bank that's beyond your sanctions, which means a bank in Russia, which has the Gazprom Bank. So we don't care. You can pay it in dollars. You can pay your gas bill in euros. Whatever you want to pay, you know, it's your choice. You can pay it in rubles, that's fine too, but you're going to pay it at our bank. And we'll take care of the rest, but you're paying it at our bank. You're paying it at a non-sanctioned bank because the West can't sanction a bank that's out of its jurisdiction, right? It can only sanction banks that are in its circuit. So it's free to sanction banks in the US, in Europe, or wherever. You can't sanction a bank inside of Russia. And that's really the essence of that story. It's not that simple. It's not that complicated. I think people have overcomplicated that whole thing. I mean, they just... You know, Putin sidestepped these guys like they were, you know, kindergartners and said, you know, pay in our bank. And that's what's going on. And like you're saying, though, the victim of all this, the people who are absorbing the brunt of what's going on are really, it's really Europe that's going to pay the price here, both in terms of higher energy prices or no heat. Take your
pick. Right. Well, that's already, you know, abundantly clear, especially in places like the UK where energy costs have already, the media there's already admitting that standard of living has been hit pretty hard there because of the extreme and rapid rise in energy costs. But a lot of people, I guess, through, you know, I guess the war propaganda have been sort of trained to, oh, it's, we'll sacrifice anything as long as we're helping Ukrainians. But I mean, it's hard to argue that the sanctions are actually like helping Ukrainians, especially with like Russia being able to easily circumvent all of this. And, you know, there's other arguments they made about how it's not necessarily helping Ukrainians either, but it's sort of manipulating sort of this empathy for people abroad as their standard of living is demolished. And I don't know, do you see this as incompetence on the part of UK leaders, the fact that they're even calling for more sanctions in the West that didn't work and probably won't work again, you know, or will be circumvented again? Is it incompetence or is there, an ulterior motive here?
I think it's part incompetence. It is part narcissistic personality disorder of some of the characters involved. And certainly some of it is deliberate. But you mentioned WEF, World Economic Forum. And I'll just tell you right now, my read of that group might be a little bit different than a lot of other people.
Sure, that's good.
In the alternative media space.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm curious about them too. Like, what is this group? Why are they getting so much attention? You know, what's up with them? And so I spent some time sort of thumbing through their website. And the first thing I noticed about the WEF, you mentioned you worked on Epstein's book, right? You did a whole book on Epstein. One of the things I noticed with Epstein, when I like going through photographs because, you know, the camera doesn't lie, right? And I go through these photographs of these people involved with Epstein, and I'm like, these are all chumps. You know, you never see like a major real power player with Epstein. It's always these chumps like Bill Gates and Larry Summers is a good example. You never see a guy like Tim Geithner. Geithner is a real power broker, okay? And I say that knowing that Geithner worked for Larry Summers when Summers was Treasury Secretary. But I'm here to tell you, Geithner never answered to Summers. It was always the other way around. Geithner is a real power player. And you never see like these major central bankers and major, you know, Geithner was president of the New York Fed. Okay. He's right. A real power broker. Geithner went to Warburg when he was done in the Obama administration.
Yeah.
read Matt Stoller's book review of Geithner's book. Even Stoller, who's a lefty, you know, so he doesn't want to be accused of being a conspiracy theorist. He's just like throwing it up stands like, oh, come on. You know, Geithner's story about, you know, one night he's in business school and he's playing pinball and he gets a phone call from Henry Kissinger. It's like, what is this guy not?
Oh, man.
So these stories are just ludicrous because it's the stuff he's leaving out so much. And what he's leaving out, Geithner, is that he's not saying he's a super connected guy. He's a real power broker. And you never see these power brokers in Jeffrey Epstein's pictures. And you'll notice the same thing when you look at the World Economic Forum photographs. You never see the major power players. It's a very corporate oriented outfit. And they do a lot of jawboning and a lot of talking, but it's most assuredly a very corporate outfit. The other thing I noticed with World Economic Forum is if you look through they have partners. You can go on their website in the partner section and it's alphabetized. You can click through. I went through the whole thing looking for law firms because that's what I know. I'm a U.S. lawyer. I know law firms. So I'm like, I wonder what law firms have partnered up with the WEF. And there's only two. I was stunned. And the two are, strangely enough, Covington and Burling, which I mentioned earlier. They represented all the Wall Street banks and those.
Yeah, very DC-connected firm.
Very DC-connected. And then the other one is Morgan, Lewis & Bockius, which is, you know, it's a big law firm. Nothing special. It's a garden variety big law firm out of Philadelphia, as I recall. But you don't see, like, any, you know, Sullivan & Cromwell, Davis Polk, Quinn Emanuel. You don't see any, you know, Kirkland & Ellis. You don't see any real showstoppers in there. Yes, Covington and it's Morgan, Lewis. It's like, yeah, okay. So that's curious to me. But the real thing that made me curious is, like, you know, WEF is in Switzerland, right?
Yeah.
If you're in Switzerland and you're an organization, there's going to be somewhere you have an agreement with Switzerland as to how you're going to conduct business with Switzerland. And the reason I know that is I did a lot of research into the Bank for International Settlements. And so there's a headquarters agreement in place. It's been in place for a long time, since I think the early 30s, between the Bank for International Settlements and Switzerland, that governs how the bank, the BIS, is going to be treated inside Switzerland. And the agreement is dead serious. It's like, okay, Switzerland, you don't have access to our documents. You can't bring us to heel at a judicial proceeding unless it's like a traffic accident. You can't subpoena our records. You can't send the police in here. You know, our data is off. Everything is off base. For all intents and purposes, the BIS is operating as a country inside of another country, which is a very significant thing. What that means is that, you know, if you're going to sue the BIS from the outside, okay, you can only get to the BIS through Switzerland. And Switzerland can't give you any powers that Switzerland itself does not have. And Switzerland, they waved bye-bye to those powers against the BIS a long time ago with that headquarters agreement. So if you're going to sue the BIS, you're not going to get shit from the BIS. You're not going to get a shred of paper. You're not going to get a witness. You're not going to get anything. You're going to get bupkis. And that's why they're there. And that's a huge thing, because the BIS and the membership of some groups within the BIS is composed of people who have real sovereign power from real countries. Treasury officials, Securities and Exchange Commission, Federal Reserve people in the U.S., and, you know, similarly placed people in countries from around the world go to the BIS, and they conduct business in complete secrecy. And it's all due to that headquarters agreement between the BIS and Switzerland. Now, by way of that background, let's look at the World Economic Forum. It has an agreement in place too. I found it on the internet. It's short and it's in German. It's in a foreign language. But I went online. I didn't have the document translated, but I did an interlinear translation through just online, dropping phrases to get them translated. And the thrust of the agreement is, it's all kind of, you know, nice sentiments. It's like, well, you know, we're going to work together in a spirit of cooperation. You know, we want the world to be a nice place. And so we're going to foster harmony. It's like, what?
Yeah, the WEF is really heavy on that fluffy
It's like language. Fluffy the cat. There's no teeth in that. You know, there's just like a joke. It's like, well, you could sue the shit out of them and you're going to get some traction for sure. So I'm not sold on the idea of the WEF being this all powerful organization.
Yeah, I agree.
Answer this question. what's the real difference between the World Economic Forum on the one hand and a country club on the other hand? Yeah, it's a place where powerful people get together. No doubt about that. But what real muscle does it have? Does it have a military? Does it issue money? Does it have sovereign power? Can it avoid prosecution? Can it avoid a subpoena? The answer to all those questions is no.
Right. So I definitely agree with you that the WEF is not this all-powerful entity that it's sort of become in some circles of alternative and independent media. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but I've had Ian Davis on my podcast a couple times now. He also contributes to my website.
Yeah, I know.
And he refers to the powers that be sort of as the global public-private partnership. He puts the Bank of International Settlements at the top of that hierarchy. And a couple levels down, he puts the World Economic Forum alongside other organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations, Chatham House, I'm blanking on some of the other, the Carnegie Endowment, some of these other groups that basically what they do is they develop policies that then, you know, are sort of given to governments by, you know, people in the middle, like Bill Gates, for example. And then the governments essentially enforce policy they didn't develop.
Yeah.
On the people. And so I sort of see the WEF in that framework. And they get a lot of attention, I think, because, you know, if you look at the Council on Foreign Relations, they're more focused on setting policy as it relates to foreign policy. The WEF develops a lot of policy documents basically touching everything, right? And they've done a lot on sort of this new, I guess, era, if you want to call it that, that we're sort of being pushed into this digital control grid. Right. As a lot of people refer to it, you know, the fourth industrial revolution and all of that, they've done a lot of focus on those types of issues, whereas the Council on Foreign Relations, for example, has done less, but still has done stuff, you know, like the Carnegie Endowment, for example, has done a lot of stuff on sort of like CBDCs and how to get them sort of in through the back door if there's a financial cyber attack and making all these weird agreements with central banks and stuff behind the scenes. That doesn't really get talked about, right? Because all the attention is on the WEF constantly. So there is a lot of, right. I think it's misdirection in a sense to focus exclusively on them. It doesn't help that Klaus Schwab is a silly Bond villain guy. I think he's criminally insane, to be sure. And I do think there are some really nefarious people involved with there that are powerful that do have a lot of influence in the WEF. I mean, you have the head of BlackRock on the board of trustees, for example, Larry Fink. He definitely has a lot of pull, not just in the U.S., but globally, right? So I would urge people to sort of see the WEF in the proper context, sort of as part of a network rather than the all-powerful top of the hierarchy and King Schwab issuing, you know, edicts from the top down. I really tend to agree more with how Ian has set up the hierarchy, because, you know, BIS issues the money. And like you said, they're accountable to no one. They're basically like operating like the Vatican almost, but, you know, as a bank in Switzerland. Well, the Vatican has a bank,
well,
too, I guess,
it's
but,
more than,
you know,
that.
Different.
It's, and I've seen that chart you mentioned, the diagram by Ian. I really like Ian Davis stuff, but he did a chart, as I recall, it's in black and white. It popped into my head when you were talking. I was like, oh yeah, I've seen that. And I remember thinking to myself, this chart's dead on. That this diagram he's got is completely on the money, in my opinion. You have the BIS at the top, but the difference between the BIS on the one hand and the Vatican on the other is the BIS, one of the entities operating within the BIS is called the Financial Stability Board. And if you look at who's on the Financial Stability Board, they're not really names, they're titles. They're titles of people in sovereign governments. It's changed over time, but when it started out, FSB started out in whatever it was, 2009, 2010, around there, the titles of people who were automatically members of the FSB from the U.S. were Chairman of the Fed, Secretary of the Treasury, Chairman of the SEC, and it was the same in England. It was Head of the Bank of England. It was Head of the Exchequer, so at one time George Osborne. And it was head of the Financial Stability Authority or some such thing. It was the SEC in England. So it's sovereign people, you know, it's representatives of sovereign governments in the FSB inside of the BIS, protected by this headquarters agreement. And the Vatican doesn't, the Vatican, you know, nobody's given automatic membership into the Vatican. And with the, but the BIS, and what you notice with the FSB is that nobody ever declined. You know, you never saw anybody go, you know, the hell with you, you know, who are you to tell me that I'm a member of your club and I'm going to come to these meetings? No one ever did that. It was like, holy shit, this is a really serious organization.
Mm-hmm. You know,
they're going there for real and conducting meetings. You know, the BIS, they meet 8 times a year, and it's major bankers who are going, you know, and major financial players, monetary players from sovereign governments who are going over there meeting. So it's a no kidding around organization. I just don't see the equivalence of that with, I think in a lot of ways, the WEF distracts your attention away from the real power brokers and the real smoke-filled rooms, because you get a chew toy like Klaus Schwab, you know, like you mentioned the bond villain.
I like the idea of him being a chew toy. Sorry. That, like, that's made me laugh.
It's like these guys, the powers of be, they throw out these chew toys and you just rah, 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 you're chewing this thing, rah, rah, like a dog. And at the end of the day, you got to go take a nap because you just pissed away all your energy on a, you know, biting a piece of rubber that didn't amount to anything. You know what I mean? Not, you know, I think that I can make a counter argument too, which is that as corporations take over governments, the power is going to move from somewhere like the BIS and the sovereign governments to a corporate power structure. But if so, why are you leaving in place why are you leaving yourself open to suits with the agreement that's in place between Switzerland and the WEF? That agreement's very weak. But then again, you know, that said, yeah, I don't have a full translation of the agreement, but it's really short, that agreement. You know, I had enough of a translator to get the flavor of it, and the flavor of it was Fluffy the cat for sure.
Well, that's like a lot of stuff the WEF puts out. This is how we're going to make a better world. We need more global governance because we can all live in harmony together, and a bunch of crap like that. I mean, that's pretty much most of their website. But they do have some policy documents that are very illuminating, and some the WEF, you know, itself is full, you know, of subcommittees and smaller alliances and organizations. And some of those are pretty significant, like the Cybersecurity Center I wrote about a lot. They have it's basically a partnership of Israeli, UK, and American law enforcement agencies and a lot of big private banks. And it basically what it is some of the agreements in there that I've written about before is in the event of a major cyber attack on the financial system, they have basically a policy mapped out that will lead to the end of both financial and online anonymity as a way to ostensibly combat ransomware. So really it's narrative setting, you know, they're developing, you know, the narrative to take us from crisis to a solution that benefits the elites, in a sense, in doing things like that with the complicity of some of these some organizations that do have a lot of pull. But I don't think the WEF by any means is the be all end all here. It's definitely, you know, sort of like I would sort of see it as a managerial type thing. And if you look at Klaus Schwab's history, and we have articles. We have two very in-depth articles on Klaus Schwab's history. He is a managerial type guy, going back to before he created the WEF. And you know, there was a lot of managerial type language in the initial founding of the WEF as well. And that's really who and what he is. And the most recent article on that that we have is about you know, the role of people like the Council on Foreign Relations and Henry Kissinger helping a young Klaus Schwab, because he was like in his early 30s, I think, when he set up the WEF, you know, essentially helping him get you know, Europe's elite on board with using that as a particular meeting space for particular purposes, right? But I think there's a reason that they've been elevated to be the bad guy, just sort of like Bill Gates is being, you know, being the main focus for a lot of people as it relates to you know, different things going on under the guise of COVID-19, right?
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't all Bill Gates, but Bill Gates does have a role that's important to examine, but blowing it out of proportion doesn't really help the issue.
Yeah, because there's no way to hold Bill Gates accountable. He's a private party. So what are you going to do? But I want to go back to something you just said. I was not aware until you just said it, that the WEF had partnerships with law enforcement agencies in different countries. That comes as news. Mm-hmm. And that is a sovereign. Law enforcement is, you know, it's a very important sovereign power to have.
Right.
To hear that there's law enforcement alliances between the WEF and law enforcement agencies in different countries, that's a serious matter.
Yeah. But it's, like I say, that's not all... The law enforcement agencies that I've seen with the WEF, that those partnerships are, you know, in these alliances that are law enforcement agencies and banks, and it's all related to cybersecurity. But it's weird that it's well, and also private cybersecurity firms, a lot of which are intelligence linked, both mainly U.S. and Israeli intelligence.
Yeah.
Linked. And the guy that directs the WEF's cybersecurity whole policy is the guy that used to set cybersecurity policy for Netanyahu in Israel. So there, you know, there's a lot, I think, going on in that particular realm. But, you know, there's, you know, I think people need to understand this particular organization and in a little more context. But basically, you know, the WEF, how they frame themselves, right, is the premier organization that promotes public-private partnerships. So those types of alliances, like the one I just mentioned with cybersecurity, they're basically setting those up like all over the world. And that's really what they do. And those, but you know, it's not the WEF is doing that for on behalf of certain parties. It's not necessarily an idea that was born in the WEF and is exclusive to the WEF. Like, you know, we've talked about, it's, you have to imagine where the WEF fits in sort of in this hierarchy.
Yeah. So I think Ian Davis's diagram is very, very helpful in that regard. A lot of the WEF seems to be directed toward marketing and policy setting. And there's not that many hard edges or really things you can hold them accountable for. They're not that overtly connected to real sovereign powers and real levers of power within governments, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. You know, like I've sort of talked about already, you know, they're building sort of these global networks, I guess, where, you know, you do have some big power players linking up with each other, and the WEF is facilitating that, not necessarily directing the power there. Right. But one of the things I talked about in that article that I wrote last year that I was referencing earlier is how it's about ending online anonymity and financial anonymity. So the first one is about basically what was proposed under the Obama administration as a driver's license for the internet, basically internet access being tied to a government issued ID. So basically, so the government can surveil everything you're doing online with the, you know, excuse of this is the only way to stop cyber attacks is essentially what the narrative is there. But the same thing too with financial anonymity, framing this as necessary to end ransomware cyber attacks. We have to be able to track and follow everything you are spending and doing with your money. And of course, one of the best ways to do that per these people is, you know, a centralized digital currency or a central bank digital currency, I would suppose. And it's interesting that in sort of this WEF organization there, which is I remembered it now, the WEF Partnership Against Cybercrime, you have a lot of players both in that's part of a broader, like the cybersecurity center of the WEF, which has a lot of involvement both of the US and Russia, which, you know, obviously now with the Ukraine situation, we're seeing these two apparently opposing blocks form, but they seem to agree about this particular policy on the way forward, at least major actors in Russia's government, and also Sberbank. And Sberbank, as I talked about on my previous podcast with Riley Wagaman, not only is it Russia's largest bank, but it's also probably their most World Economic Forum connected financial institution. But it's worth pointing out that, you know, Cyber Polygon and all of this stuff had the direct involvement of Russia's government. The keynote was given by the Russian prime minister, and you had the Bank of Russia, their central bank, their deputy governor, talking about how great central banks are for controlling the population at the WEF's Cyber Polygon exercise last year. So I can read a quote from that later. So if you're okay with talking about some of this digital currency stuff now, John. Maybe we can get into some of the CBDC stuff going on, because it is sort of related to a lot of what we're talking about or have been talking about today, and also specifically in the context of it being sort of part of this end game that we both were talking about earlier. You know, the idea of a central bank digital currency seems to be very important to that for the powers that be. And it seems like there have been some developments on both sides of the of, you know, the people backing the various blocks that have formed in this you know, the Ukraine-Russia conflect seem to be basically in agreement with you know, this particular agenda, for at least for domestic use, having a central bank digital currency with which to, you know, sort of financially control you know, their domestic populations.
Yeah, so to me, the big questions with central bank digital currencies, and I know we talked about a little bit of this last time, are number one, what is backing the central bank digital currency? Because remember, everybody agrees from Carstens on down, Carstens being the general manager of the BIS, and Jay Powell and everybody else agrees, central bank digital currencies are going to be the third liability on a central bank balance sheet. The first two being cash, which is physical, and reserves, which are electronic. So central bank digital currency would be the third liability. The first two liabilities, cash and reserves, those are liabilities, and the corresponding asset tends to be a bond, an IOU from a government, say the U.S., to whoever holds the bond. Just IOU, you know, $1 billion plus interest. But it's a bond from a country, or if it's a mortgage-backed security, it's, you know, 5,000 mortgages. But the point is, it's a mass bond. It's not atomized down on the individual level. And the question, first question with central bank digital currencies is, are you going to, if I have $1,000 of CBDC, what is backing that currency? Is it a part of a mass bond, like an IOU of the U.S., or is it me? Am I the backing? And that's a big question, because if it's been atomized and it's down to the individual level, then you are on a very slippery slope to just an outright slavery system, where they control mm-hmm. everything you do. You know, you're just an asset. You're literally an asset on the Fed's balance sheet. You know, and your personal autonomy is out the window. And then you're going to see all these people making bets on your success or failure. You know, taking out insurance policies on you. It's, you know, it's an ugly dystopian scene. So that's a very critical question you want to ask. The second big question with CBDC is, who is the issuer? And that boils down to who's sovereign. So let's start with CBDC out of the Fed. The Fed would issue, the Federal Reserve in the U.S. would issue the central bank digital currency. They've said as much. Although I've seen proposals, including one you sent to me recently, that says, well, maybe the Treasury should issue it. I'll put that on the back burner for now. If the Fed is issuing the CBDC, who owns the Federal Reserve? Well, the issuer of the Federal Reserve, you just go to the Federal Reserve balance sheet, you go to the H.4.1 report, it comes out every week, and you look at the balance sheet, you'll see that there's 12 issuing entities when it comes to liabilities and assets on the Fed's balance sheet. And the 12 individual entities are the regional district Federal Reserve Bank. So Bank of New York, Bank of Boston, Philadelphia, Atlanta on the East Coast, and then Cleveland, you know, Chicago, St. Louis, so on and so forth. There's 12 banks. Those 12 regional Federal Reserve District banks are privately owned, which means you're the issuer of the currency is private, and really who's has the sovereign power in the U.S. is its private corporations. And you can get to that conclusion whether you get to it from who's issuing your money, or if you get to it from who is immune from prosecution, the result is the same. It's the people who own the banks, period. They're immune from prosecution and they issue money. That's the sovereign power in the U.S. So that's a real problem with central bank digital currency insofar as the U.S. is concerned. when you go to places like China and Russia, to me, you know, I don't know as much about those jurisdictions that, you know, I'm just not an expert on China and Russia. I can't tell you who the real sovereign power in Russia is. I mean, when I see in China, for example, people committing fraud and getting executed, it's just like, well, I guess the people who just got executed weren't sovereign and they were bankers because they're dead now as a result of crimes that by definition work a harm on the public. So there's some question to me as to who the sovereign power in China and Russia are. At the end of the day, I'm not sure that it makes much of a difference. I don't want to be controlled. I guess if you're a slave, it doesn't matter whether you're controlled by a private corporation or by a government, by a sovereign.
Yeah, you're still a slave.
Mm-hmm. You're still under control either way.
Right.
And so, you know, at some point, you got to say to yourself, I'm going to stop wasting time or stop. Not wasting time, but I'm going to stop studying. I'll study it to a certain point. Who's in control of what? And I'm going to turn my attention to what can I do about it? Right. Yeah.
Good point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, what is my role in this, and how can I protect myself, regardless of how many angels you can fit on a pinhead?
Yeah. Well, you know, the argument, there's a lot of debate actually about, you know, who's really in control of Russia or China, right? We had a, Unlimited Hangout co-hosted a panel, or I guess you could call it a debate, with Off Guardian, you know, about that exact question. And, you know, one of the arguments there is that, Russia and China are in sort of, they say they're in like DEFCON 2, phase. And so a lot of these extreme measures they've taken with like COVID or other things that are analogous to policies that a lot of us are critical of in the West are just being done because of that. And another argument was that Russia and China have sort of like fifth columns and there's this, you know, factional struggle. But I would really urge people, you know, I think every government has factions within it that struggle with each other, but I don't really think any of those factions are 100% white hats or can even really be called the good guys. They're just different interest groups. I think some people tend to, you know, want to look for the quote unquote good guys. In any sort of scenario here, it's very easy to be like, these are the good guys and those are the bad guys, and have sort of that binary thinking. But I think, you know, frequently, more often than not, at least, you know, the reality is usually a lot more nuanced. So in the case of Russia and their, you know, plans for this, for a CBDC, I mentioned earlier a quote from the deputy governor of the Bank of Russia, Alexei Zabotkin, who spoke at the last Cyber Polygon cybersecurity exercise hosted by the World Economic Forum and co-hosted with them by a subsidiary of Sberbank, Russia's largest bank. So what he said there is, what he basically says is that, you know, he says, well, I'll just quote him. Better to get it straight from his words. Yeah. So he says this, meaning the digital ruble, will permit better traceability of payments and money flow, and also explore the possibility of setting conditions on permitted terms of use of a given unit of currency. And then he basically said, this is paraphrasing him now, that parents could give digital currency to their children with certain restrictions, like blocking them from buying junk food. It's programmable money, right?
Yeah.
Then he goes on to say that would be a useful functionality for a customer. And of course, you can come up with hundreds of other similar use cases, not necessarily for children. That's me adding that. Anyway, he says, according to him, the digital rubles, quote, last mile access will remain in the hands of the commercial banks, plus possibly other authorized and properly supervised payment service providers. And then he goes on to say the Bank of Russia will maintain the centralized ledger on the Bank of Russia's technological platform. All transactions will be recorded on this ledger. So what are your thoughts on that? Does it sound any different than other CBDC systems you've been following?
Certainly there's some similarities and some alarming similarities, but it's not dispositive because there's unanswered questions. number one is who owns the Russian, who owns Russia's central bank? Is it Russia or is it private entities? You know, I like with the New York Fed and with the regional Federal Reserve banks in the U.S., for sure, they are owned by private entities. There's mm-hmm. the reason I know that is there's a publication by the New York Fed in 1977 called I'll Bet You Thought, written by a guy named David Friedman. You can go read it right there. It's an admission by the New York Fed. It says, yeah, we're owned, you know, those regional Federal Reserves are owned by private entities. It's not mm-hmm. part, it's not part of the government.
It's public-private.
It's not. No. It's not public-private. It's private, period, full stop.
No, I mean the whole system, I guess, the whole central banking system. Not even that.
Not in the U.S. It's not. That's another sales point that people try to. It's the Fed apologists. Okay, Fed apologists try to tell you, oh well, there's the Board of Governors, and the Board of Governors is part of the government, and they, you know, FOMC is a mix of the Board of Governors and the regional. It's like, yeah, cut the shit. Okay. The issue, who issues the money in the U.S.? It's the 12 regional Federal Reserve Bank, mm-hmm. and they're privately owned. How much money was the Board of Governors issue? It doesn't issue a penny. The right. Treasury issues more in pennies than the Board of Governors issues. Okay, so just get rid of the Board. Forget the Board of Governors. It's the regional Federal Reserves. They issue the money, and they're privately owned. They say so. They tell you that. So the question in Russia is, who owns the Russian Central Bank? You know, and I don't know the answer to that. The second question is it really the same? Are they going to eliminate cash? Because cash obviously gets around the anonymity problem. But I guess the answer to that in the U.S., they keep saying they're going to eliminate cash. And I look at the Fed balance sheet. It's like, well, there's $2.3 trillion of cash out there. It does look to be far from eliminated. So I don't know. You know?
Well, I think the threat is it could be eliminated at some time. And if it were, the possibility of that is enough to oppose its launch, I guess. I say this because on March 17th, in Russia anyway, the Duma, their state legislature, proposed yep. replacing the fiat ruble with a digital ruble.
That's disturbing. Yeah, that's not good.
Yeah, so they frame this as countering sanctions, but of course the digital ruble project has been in the works since 2017, so it's not like a new thing that was just dreamt up to counter relatively recent Western sanctions. To me, it looks like they're sort of using the sanctions as an excuse to sort of legalize and bring into existence this particular system that's you know, been in the works for a long time. And if I believe also that Spurbank, which has launched its Spur coin and is very much involved with the WEF. They were given a license last month by Russia also to issue digital currency and launch their own coin as a means of circumventing Western sanctions. But I believe that Spurbank is now mostly owned by the Russian central bank, but I may have to double check that. But it's definitely has a majority of its ownership is related to the Russian government. I'm pretty sure that's the entity that owns it, but I'll, you know, have to double check to be 100% on that. But anyway, if the Duma does go about and move to replace the fiat ruble with the digital ruble, as has now been proposed, you know, I guess that sort of makes, you know, Russia pegging the ruble to the gold a little, you know, that sort of puts that in a different light, because, you know, it's a stable coin then. It's not really the same as, you know, the gold standard that a lot of, you know, some people in alternative media sort of idealize. I don't know. Your thoughts?
You have to remember that Russia and China and the U.S. and really everywhere in the world has a two-tier monetary system, meaning that there's two issuers of money in the system. There's the commercial bank layer, which is our layer, and they've been issuing digital money for a long time. You know, in the U.S., it's Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and all the rest issuing. You know, they create digital money all the time, every day. Every time they issue a loan, they're creating money. The counterpart to that is Spurbank in Russia and other commercial banks in Russia. Regardless of who they own, they're issuing debt-based money. That's just how the monetary system works around the world. It's a two-tiered system. And the first tier, the top tier, is the tier that's closer to the sovereign government. And that's the tier that's issuing cash, that's issuing reserves. Okay, so when you talk about the digital ruble, you know, I tell you, there already is a digital ruble. There's been a digital ruble for a long time. I don't really know what it means when Sberbank is coming out with a different digital. What are you talking about? They already issued digital money. I know that because that's how the two-tiered monetary system works right now. So I'm not really tracking what's going on. But again, it comes back to something you mentioned, which is who owns Sberbank? Who's the real owner of Sberbank? That's at the commercial bank level. In the U.S., the commercial banks are all privately owned,
mm-hmm.
right? That may or may not be true in Russia and China. I don't know. But the ultimate question, it always comes down to who is the real sovereign power in Russia and in China? Is it private banks like it is in the U.S.? There's no question about that in the U.S. That's documented. The private banks are running everything. You can't prosecute them, and they issue money. Ball game. I don't know that that's the case in Russia or in China. And when you look at the Ukraine and the battle going on there, you know, it looks to me like, well, you know, nobody questioning whether, you know, Putin's a guy in Russia, Lavrov, and really any number of public officials in Russia. These are not people who bluff a lot. You know, they say stuff and they tend to mean it, has been what I've observed. So I have a hard time seeing, you know, people in Russia in this battle with the Ukraine, really, which is a battle against the U.S., let's face it.
It's a proxy conflict, yeah.
It's a proxy war. It's a proxy war. And the U.S. does not want to have its military get waxed out in public, because then the dollar's in real trouble. So it's a proxy war. And they're happy to do that because it's like, well, who cares? It's Ukrainian. It's not U.S. bodies. We don't have to answer. U.S. population doesn't care. We're just a bunch of Europeans. A bunch of Ukrainian gets killed. So what? I mean, I hate to be cynical, but that's how those people think. But I have a hard time seeing, to me, that battle in Ukraine, it's for all the marbles. Meaning the U.S. wants to control everything. It wants to be the hegemon. It wants to be the one that boss around other countries. And it's screaming bloody murder when people don't go along. And so, you know, it's chips all in for Russia, because they said, you know, no one is really denying that there are biolabs on the border of Ukraine and Russia. No one's really denying the fact that, you know, Ukraine was well on its way to getting nuclear weapons in that country. No one is really denying the fact that Ukraine's got some severe Nazi problem in that country,
mm-hmm.
and was laying waste to places like Luhansk and Donetsk. Nobody really denying those things. Those are all very real concerns to Russia. I find those, you know, that's a real battle. And that's what Russia was concerned about. They don't want nuclear superiority. They don't want nuclear first strike capability being inside Ukraine. And that's where things were headed. So to me, this is an existential battle for Russia on the one hand. I don't have any doubt about that in my mind. I don't mm-hmm. think this is some fake conflict, you know, or some imaginary, you know, pissing contest. It's a real war going on from Russia's point of view. Okay.
Yeah. To bring up Ian Davis again, he has made the argument. He actually makes it, well, I think it was published before the Ukraine conflict really exploded. But it's basically, his argument is that, you know, the Russia-China bloc and the U.S. bloc are sort of fighting over, you know, the unipolar model, which I guess is the U.S. hegemony, and the multipolar model, which is what Russia and China are supporting. But ultimately, the operating system, as he calls it, of the world, the world order, I guess, that both of those blocks separately wish to, you know, foist upon the world. Ultimately, you know, it's technocracy at the end of the day, of which, you know, central bank digital currencies is a key part of that, or the idea of programmable money controlled, you know, by a centralized entity, which, you know, in most cases is going to be the, mostly all cases, I would assume anyway, is going to be the central bank. And that basically what you're seeing is you're seeing a fight over who gets what seat at the table, but it's still the same table.
I think in loose terms, that's correct. Because remember, I said, regardless of where you are in the world, you have a debt-based monetary system. Meaning this, it's not really, you know, it's a two-tiered system where private banks are issuing your money at the retail level, and it creates a debt problem. And that's true in China. That's true in Russia. It's banks issuing the money at one level, and really whether it's this, it's the central bank in all these countries too. Whether the central bank is privately owned or publicly owned, it's the central bank at the top tier too. So he's right. It's a battle between unipolar on the one hand and a unipolar model that's dying, by the way, because the currency is dying for the reasons that I set forth. That you're borrowing to make the interest payment now. The U.S. is at the end of the debt-based monetary system. It's ball game. It's over because the U.S. is advanced. We've gotten rid of our manufacturing. We've sold that off. You know, we don't really have productive capacity anymore. What we've got left is a casino. No, it's a casino.
I agree. It's just it's a really succinct way of framing it.
You don't have any industry. you got rid of your industry. Now you're a casino, and you have two. Your exports are fraud and war. You know, good luck. And now you're borrowing money to make interest payment to your population. You're in real trouble. So this is like what's going on in Ukraine. It's a last gasp for the U.S., which is not even engaged in battle. It has to do this by sanctions and whatnot for various reasons. But that's to try to preserve the unipolar model. This is it, because the debt is going to take off. I mean, you have public officials saying the debt is going to kill you, basically. And so this is it. You get world control, you solve your problem. Okay. But in the multipolar model is not going to do the U.S. any good, because if your currency is done, you're done. Russia and China, they have a debt-based monetary system too, but they're way earlier in the knee of that exponential curve. Like if you look at debt to GDP, that's one convenient yardstick of how much debt you have. And the U.S., it's sitting at 135% and it's trending north fast. If you look at debt to GDP in Russia, it's something like 20%. You know, Russia and China, they still have manufacturing. You know, they still have productive capacity in those countries for the time being. Eventually, they'll lose it too, because the debt-based monetary system is a cancer that ultimately ends up eating everything and turning you into casino. So, you know, what you have is a situation now where it's like the debt-based monetary system, it's like the scorpion of the scorpion in the frog fable. And now the scorpion is on frog number one with the red, white, and blue frog. And it's bitten a frog. It's going to sink to the bottom. So what's the scorpion going to do? It's going to jump over to, you know, the hammer and sickle frog and ride it for a while. Or the Chinese frog is going to ride that for a while. It's going to bite those frogs too. But it's those systems, Russia and China, are much more viable in the debt-based monetary construct because they don't have that much debt thus far. Eventually they will. And that's my read, or kind of how I see agreement with what Ian's saying, that it's unipolar on the one hand versus multipolar on the other. But either way, you're going to end up with a debt-based monetary system.
Well, the way that there was a joint statement issued by the Russian and Chinese governments at the beginning of February, and basically the way they lay out their multipolar vision is to basically, you know, have the UN have a greater role, essentially. And, you know, as we've seen, it's not exactly like the UN puts the global public's sentiments at the heart of its decision making. It essentially functions like a public-private partnership, and they tend to overly value, at least now, the opinions and will of the private sector and, you know, some very powerful billionaires. In what Kofi Annan, when he was director general of the UN, called a silent revolution or quiet revolution, something like that, in the late 90s. You know, that shift there away from, you know, the way most people think about the UN, which is like, oh, here's all these, governments that are just, you know, it's just the public sector, a meeting of the different public sector representatives of the world coming together to make global decisions. It doesn't really work like that in practice anymore. And there's a lot in that joint statement that I really find very disconcerting, including, you know, support for some of the crazy stuff going on behind the guise of the Green New Deal and the green agenda, which is, you know, there's a reason the UN put Mark Carney in charge of that. You know, put a central banker in charge of that shift. I mean, it's basically a scam, a lot of the stuff that they're pushing for there. you know, that I've written about before, like, you know, in this like natural asset corporation stuff and the financialization of nature, they've put the UN is intimately involved in a lot of that stuff. And that was, you know, known before Russia and China came out and say, yeah, well, let's have the UN basically do everything. But with the idea that, you know, it, basically the BRICS countries, you know, would replace the unipolar model of the U.S. Hegemon, but BRICS is, you know, a handful of countries instead of one, but I don't really see it in practice as being necessarily that different for what's going on. I certainly don't see it as being a utopia, as some have sort of sought to paint it. So I definitely think people should be taking it with a grain of salt.
So the question to me with CBDCs that you could pose both to the U.S. and to Russia and China, be interesting to get honest answers, would be this. If you have a CBD system throughout the globe and everybody is, each country is issuing its third liability on the balance sheet, CBDCs, you know, and you're trading cross-border, basically your countries, that system you can sort of analogize to the system you have with commercial banks. Like when I said, you've issued, your bank issues $100 and my bank issues $200 and they trade, you know, at the end of the day, you have to settle between those two banks, right? They have to have some means of settling because I'm holding $200 of your IOUs and you're only holding $100 of my IOUs. You know, I owe you $100, right? Or no, you owe me $100 because I'm holding more of your IOUs and that banks have to settle with reserves. When you go to the CBDC system and now countries are issuing potentially liabilities to each other, you have to have a settlement system there too. So the question is, how are you going to settle payments in different currencies at the global level? And so one answer would be, well, maybe, you know, maybe the IMF issues a reserve currency that's a settlement currency. They wouldn't call a reserve currency. That's too politically hot. So they would call it something like, they try to sell it as innocuous. We just need a currency to settle transactions between cross borders. And the question is, who is issuing that settlement currency? Mm-hmm. Because the issuer of the settlement currency within the U.S. system is the Federal Reserve. It issues reserves. And the Federal Reserve has the power and the capacity to bankrupt any of the commercial banks under it, okay? Because it can freely issue as many liabilities as it wants, but the commercial banks can't because the people who bank at the commercial banks could turn around and ask for cash and bye-bye the bank goes if it can't meet the demand for cash from the customer, okay? So the Federal Reserve is top dog in the U.S. system because it is the issuer of the settlement currency and because it can issue as much settlement currency as it wants with total impunity ever since we went off the gold standard in 1971. When you go to the global level and you have a settlement currency issuer, who is the entity issuing that currency? And the question is, would you, Russia, agree to let the IMF issue the settlement currency? And the answer is almost certainly no, they wouldn't, because you know they're just not going to commit suicide like that. But it all comes down to who is going to issue the ultimate currency in that system. And it sounds like what China and Russia are proposing is it can't be the U.S. number one, and it can't be it's got to be a combination of people or a combination of nations so that interests are all represented. Do you follow me?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to that question, and I'm not sure ultimately it matters, but that would be one question I would want to have answered. And I think that would highlight some differences that may or may not exist with respect to CBDCs on the sovereign level.
Okay. Well, you know, there's still plenty of time for this to play out. So we'll see what happens.
There's a lot of time for it to play out. The U.S. is headed into real problems with inflation. And if you look at the money figures right now, they're not looking good. We're looking like we were in the summer of 2008.
Hmm. Well, is there sort of like a time frame that you can sort of put on this then when things are going to get really, really dire for the dollar?
Well, classically, you know, the bad time in the U.S. is in the fall. So, I'd be real careful, you know, come September. You got to be careful all the time. But you have rising interest rates now. You have oil price that's been north of $100 for now. You've got inflation. The PPI, Super Producer Price Index, came out yesterday. It's hot. The CPI, inflation is hot. But the thing that opens my eyes the most is whenever you see the retail money supply start to tick down, retail money supply meaning, bank deposits, basically, those bank deposits are now headed south. And whenever that happens, it's almost automatically trouble in the U.S. And here we're sitting in April, the money supply is ticking down. Boy, I don't know. There are too many balls in the air right now with Ukraine. There's global conflicts all over the place. It's not just Ukraine. You know, now you've got Finland looking to be a hot spot. There's trouble everywhere. So there's a lot of unpredictability right now. Not to mention the fact that, don't forget, these vaccination nuts, these injection nuts, they're not done. Okay, they're not dropping that anytime soon. The notion that we're through the lockdowns, I wouldn't be so sure about that either.
Yeah, they've pretty much signaled it will come back at some point. And it's very possible it could happen right when a dire economic crisis dawns. How convenient to have people, we have to lock you up for your health when normally you'd be protesting in the streets because your money's disappeared or something like that. Or the other possibility in the U.S. is that they finally, in earnest, launch the war on domestic terror, which the infrastructure of which was set out by Biden last year and includes people who you can be a terrorist if you don't agree, if you think the government has engaged in unconstitutional overreach, for example, or if you oppose corporate globalization or capitalism. It's a very broad definition of domestic terrorist that they're working with. And
yeah, total nose of wax, completely unconstitutional. It's right on its face. But this is ultimately the problem with letting, when you lose the rule of law like the U.S. had by not prosecuting banks, by not even investigating banks, this is what you get. You get criminals running your system. Of course, it's unpredictable. You don't know what
they're going to criminalize dissent against them is where this is essentially going. And, what happened after 2008 with Occupy Wall Street, when they let the cat out of the bag that the biggest swindle ever has taken place. That's when a lot of the stuff that we talk about as it relates to domestic terror and these efforts to really put in the digital control grid and all of that stuff are really going to go live, I think, in the U.S. in a big way, because they don't want to be held accountable. That's the whole point, right?
So yeah, that's a great point about Occupy Wall Street. But that was the first time that I remember banks sitting down in the same room with police agencies. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot more of that public-private cooperation as this economic situation, specifically in the U.S. as it relates to the dollar, starts to unfold. Do you see sort of this de-dollarization that's happening and how that's going to impact U.S. Standards of living? Do you see that as becoming sort of like a selling point to an unwitting public for a U.S. CBDC, for a digital dollar?
That's an interesting notion. It's hard to predict, criminal behavior, but for sure I could see them marketing that. Because, inflation is going to tear people apart. A recession would push a lot of people over the edge. And then UBI and CBDC, Universal Basic Income, would be dangled out as a branch to safety, as a platform to safety. So yeah, I could see any number of things playing out like that. By the way, one interesting thing about CBDC in the U.S. is there's a lot of slow walking going on in the U.S. on CBDC. Biden administration came out and said, we're looking at CBDC and we're thinking about putting together a steering committee to write a white paper on whether we should pursue. I mean, it's just like—
You mean the executive order? Came out.
What a joke. Are you kidding me? It's almost like the foot dragging on CBDC is deliberate.
Maybe so, but I sent this link to you earlier before we started, but after that executive order was launched, the private sector or private financial sector launched something called Project Lithium, which is related to the Digital Dollar Project, which is a nonprofit that was formed to advocate for a U.S. CBDC. And this Project Lithium, the Digital Dollar Project, is co managing is being done in tandem with a clearing and settlement firm that's a private, I believe, called the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation.
Yeah.
So basically, you have on this digital dollar project, you have the former U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission chairman. You have some other interesting characters like Accenture, which is part of ID 2020, and they're part of the WEF and very much involved in sort of this fourth industrial revolution, digital ID, digital currency stuff. And then what's interesting, it looks like that particular former CFTC chairman is a guy whose last name is, it's J. Christopher Giancarlo. And one of the other people involved in the project is an investor named Charles Giancarlo. I'm not sure if they're related, but I suspect that they may be. But what's interesting about this investor, private investor, they don't really list what he in media reports, what he's an investor in. But it's interesting to note that he's a former top executive at Cisco, which is one of the big tech companies, very much involved in some of the WEF cybersecurity initiatives I talked about earlier in the podcast, and one of the main drivers of the Internet of Things and all of this stuff, right? But he was also he's also a top guy at a Silver Lake Partners. I'm not sure if he's still there, but he was there for a long time. But Silver Lake is interesting because I don't know if people remember the SolarWinds hack, but Silver Lake had apparently had foreknowledge of the SolarWinds hack before it happened, because they were one of two private equity firms that accounted for 75% of SolarWinds, I guess, ownership. And they reduced their exposure significantly and sold a considerable stake in the business right before the hack happened. So you can ask yourself why that may have happened. And for people that don't remember the SolarWinds hack, I wrote about it not that long after it happened, and the ties of that hack happening, it seems to have been related with the hack itself to the acquisition of a Israeli intelligence connected tech firm that has ties to the Maxwell family. Yes, that Maxwell family, as opposed to the official narrative. But it sort of ties into some of the other reporting that I referenced earlier about, you know, how a cyber attack is going to, you know, at least as the WEF and some of these alliances within the WEF have sort of planned out how that will lead to the end of online and financial anonymity. It's interesting to see those players popping up to an extent around the digital dollar project, as it's called. But basically what this is about, that this partnership I'm talking about here, Project Lithium, the CBDC pilot, they say it's intended to explore the potential benefits of a CBDC spelling out the value it could bring to the financial services industry. So I sort of see it as them sort of making a sales pitch, you know, a very detailed sales pitch of why, you know, CBDC will enrich the banks. I don't know. What's your take on all of this?
Well, the insofar as Project Lithium is concerned, that article you sent me, let me read you. I mean, the DTCC, just let people know, you know, just like you have to settle monetary transactions between two banks. Like if I transfer money to you, you know, that money doesn't really get transferred, right? The way that works is the money in my account gets deleted and it gets recreated by your bank in your account. And what really gets transferred is reserves. Okay. So you have to have that's sort of a settlement process. The DTCC kind of does the same thing, but it does it with securities. Okay. They settle securities transaction. The appearance of the DTCC, privately held Depository Trust Clearing Corporation, in connection with CBDCs, is horrifying for the reason that I mentioned earlier. And that is that it's sort of, you could have a situation with CBDCs where the individual backs their own CBDC. So I would be the asset backing the $1,000 in my account, right? That's a securities transaction at that point, since you're an asset.
And securitizing humanity. Yeah.
Securitizing humanity. The seeing the DTCC show up in the system in that article is like seeing, you know, a guy with a face mask and a leather shirt and a chainsaw come into a room. Like that's not you're coming to a horror film. That's not a good scene. You don't want to see that.
All right. Well, that's a very useful analogy for people to associate Project Lithium with. So for people who are hearing of this for the first time, and I only really recently heard of it myself, you know, that seems Chainsaw Man in the Room is definitely something to watch. Yeah. So keep an eye out for
shirt, hockey mask, Chainsaw Man just showed up at your camp, at your campfire. but he's just here because he is all about inclusivity. Okay.
So yeah, well,
you don't worry about a thing.
Well, yeah, that's been one of the selling points of the digital dollar so far, at least, you know, the way they're selling a CBDC in Russia, right, is, oh, this is how we're going to circumvent sanctions. But at the in the U.S., you know, this is going on at the same time. And they're saying, well, a digital dollar will help the poor. It's more financially inclusive than cash. I don't know. It just seems kind of like a silly argument to me.
Chainsaw Man, to quote the article, is here to speed up payments globally and give consumers greater access to the financial system.
Oh, goody.
Don't you feel better?
Yeah, totally. Oh, man. I think this is the way all these sort of discussions should be framed in, like, horror movie analogies. That way people will understand a little more of what we're dealing with. And I think that's would actually, to be honest, probably help a lot, because, you know, financial stuff can sometimes be really dry for people and people's eyes glaze over, like, oh, all these terms, but if you're like, chainsaw in a room coming at you, you know, then people sort of pay attention. So I don't know.
Get in line. Chainsaw Man's got some coupons for you.
All right. Well, we've been going for a while, so I guess we should probably leave it on that. On that note,
note. Very good.
Yeah, right. So, John, would you mind letting people know where they can find your work and how they can support you?
I'm on my channel is called Best Evidence, and it is on YouTube. It is on BitChute. It is on Odyssey. And I have not yet, even though I've been doing it since 2014 or 15, I have not yet monetized my videos. So eventually I'll get around to that.
Well, maybe not do it on YouTube, because they're really good at demonetizing people that they don't like.
I'm not giving YouTube a chance to screw me. So I'm not monetizing anything.
I never even made a YouTube channel for that very reason. Yeah. So, you know, I definitely, you know, I actually just wrote a report that's going to come out in the next print edition of Bitcoin Magazine, just about how insane all this censorship is and how really it's this fusion of the national security state with companies like Google that are driving the censorship agenda. And there's a lot of really sinister stuff behind the scenes there. And it's really already being the war's already being waged by AI and the developers of that AI used to develop software to track insurgents in Iraq and places like that. And they basically want to have intelligence agencies decide what is true and then have big tech enforce that with no room for appeal. That's the policy being pushed out right now, which is really wild. Yeah. But I guess some of us saw this coming.
Nothing could go wrong there.
Nope. And just let the CIA, that's never lied before, tell you what's real and what's not. That'll work.
God,
that's terrible. It's nuts. Anyway, so thank you, John, so much for taking the time to explain to me and to my audience a lot of this crazy, really crazy historic financial stuff going on right now and what it means. For those, I would really encourage people to share John's work around, because it's really some of the best there is about explaining very complicated financial stuff in a way that's very easy to understand. And I know that I got a lot of positive feedback the first time you were on from people who were really thrilled to have come across your analysis. So definitely keep it up, because a lot of people definitely appreciate you and appreciate your work. And I am one of them. So for those of you listening, please consider supporting not just John's work, but also this podcast and sharing this podcast around as widely as you can when it's publicly available. As everyone should pretty much know by now, the first couple days I have it paywalled on Rockfin and for unlimited Hangout subscribers, but after that it's publicly available pretty much everywhere, and there's a lot of important information covered in here, so I would really encourage you to try and help disseminate that to the best of your ability, because of the extreme censorship climate that will only continue to worsen with time. With that being said, thanks so much everyone for listening to this podcast, and catch you all on the next episode.